talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warning. You're running down my country. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a far-down key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a far-down key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. You run down my country, man. You walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. I saw this cartoon today. Well, I shouldn't say not exactly a cartoon. It's a it's a picture and with a caption, and I put it up on my Facebook and like to circulate that around, and. I think it is quite funny, and well worth people well circulating. Anyway, it's a picture of this discredited Negro homosexual. I believe he's an actor. I don't know if it's a comedian. I never watched Empire, but it's there's a picture of him. When it says, "When America is so great that you have to hire two dudes from Nigeria to oppress you," of course the story is this, and it's now come out in Chicago, and it was interesting to see a very angry black Negro chief of police denouncing what. Jussie Smollett had done, and you may recall about 2 weeks ago, Jussie Smollett had alleged that he'd been out on the streets of Chicago about 2 a.m. in the morning, and that in itself ought to raise some serious questions in any reasonable person's mind. But okay, and he was assaulted by two men in hoodies, who put a noose around his neck, a length of rope around his neck, threw some bleach at him, used racial and anti-homosexual slurs, I'm not sure that we were told what they were. At least the reports, as usual, are very cute and they don't quite give us the exact words. But anyway, there was much boo-hoo-hooing and all the racism, and even in this day and age, and even though he's an actor, and even though he's successful, it's enough to break your heart, and on and on and on it went. Well, when I was on the Daily Ken, sorry, on the Ethno State radio show with Ken Givenan and William Johnson, and I believe it was that week we were with James Edwards of the Political Cesspool. We were commenting the day after the story broke, and we all had our doubts. I mean, and I pointed out that back in the 1990s, there was a rash of over 250 supposed attacks on black churches, and that really had the mainstream media in a knot. They just, because it was all pinned on white supremacists. White supremacists had done these terrible things, and they burnt, and it's bad enough to attack blacks, but to target churches is just beyond the pale. Well, a researcher by the name of Laird Wilcox in Kansas, over the next few years, did a lot of research. And what did he find out? That of these 200 and some attacks, not a single one had in fact been perpetrated by white people, by white supremacists or white nationalists or even white opponents of the blacks. I think some fires turned out to be just accidental. But where there was arson, there was a wide variety of causes. In some cases, the Negro pastors burned their own church down for insurance. In some cases, an angry parishioner, or just a nutcase, lit the fire. One particularly laughable case, it was an outraged husband. The pastor being having an affair with the man's wife. So he burned that church down and tried to. Anyway, the point was... and in the end, although this was widely laid at the feet of the white nationalist movement, and people like Bill Clinton mumbling on about that atmosphere of hate, and of course that was laid to some of the talk radio folks at the time. It was the atmosphere of hate that they had created. Well, it turns out that no black church was burned down by angry white people. More recently, there have been many incidents of supposed anti-Semitic incidents that turns out to be caused, not by white supremacists or neo-Nazis, whatever they are, but in fact were perpetrated by anti-racists or by Jews themselves. For instance, about a year ago, there was quite a rash of threats made to Jewish community centers and synagogues right across the United States. Even Donald Trump got sucked in by this, and he condemned it, and so on. Well, not very long after that, they got to the bottom of it. No, it wasn't some admirer of Adolf Hitler living in his mummy's basement. It was, in fact, a Jew, a former member of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, operating out of Israel. And this is very quickly quieted down, it was hinted that he might have mental issues, you think? Or maybe something else. The media, of course, is always only too ready to believe this type of stuff, because they are pathologically anti-white. And the story narrative is...
good minorities, you know, black or homosexual or whatever, or bad whites. Minorities, good guys, whites, bad guys. So all they have to do in most of these cases is fit the story, fit the details into the story. And that's all it is. Well, in instance after instance, it turns out not to be a case of bad whites. Well, anyway, with Jussie, don't know what that stands for, but Jussie Smollett, it turns out that he'd hired two Nigerian, I believe they're bodybuilders. It just gets so funny. And he'd coached them. He even gave them a check, his own check, I think it was for about $100, with instructions to go to a fashion store to buy the, I guess it was the balaclavas and various other things that they were going to wear, and Make America Great Again hat, and so on, and the noose. In the wake of this attack, because he's an important minority person, a favored minority, the Chicago police spent a king's ransom on trying to solve this relatively minor, even if it had been exactly as he described. It was a minor assault. They didn't pull the noose around his neck. They didn't try to lynch him on the spot. It was basically intimidation, if it was as he said. But because he was an important, privileged minority, they put 12 seasoned detectives on this case round the clock. And I heard people on the chattering media today wondering, well, what would that mean? Well, if it was literally around the clock, that would be three shifts. The manpower and the cost. There was extensive review of these TV monitoring cameras that seem to be everywhere, and then of course monitoring or at least examination of Smollett's cell phone and so on. What they pieced together was this: that Smollett had even gone with these two alleged racist, anti-homosexual Nigerians. Did I mention Nigerians? The day before, to do dry run of the event. He had contacted them before and after the event. He had bought them tickets back to Nigeria. And they even contacted them when they were in Istanbul after the event. I'm not quite clear how they got back or whether they were sent back, but they've been cooperating with the police. And he is being charged with causing a disturbance, which in Illinois law is more serious than, you know, just getting rowdy at a bar. It's what we in Canada would call public mischief. So the police were quite rightly vexed beyond endurance, not only by the effrontery, but by the time and resources it had cost. And there's some thinking, he was charged and released on $100,000 bail today, but there's some thinking that when, if he's convicted, and I assume that's more like when he's convicted, his sentence will include a hefty fine to compensate, or at least partly compensate, the police for the cost of investigating what turned out to be a hoax. Well, what was his reason? Well, his reason was he wanted more money in his acting, and he thought maybe if he could become a real bona fide victim of the bad white guy, this would work. This incident also, to me, demonstrates that the terrible weakness of our system for these minority lies. It's a healthier system would have just simply brushed them off and said, come on, okay,
So two dudes called you some bad names and so on. But they know it works, and they know it works because of our weakness, and because we cater to these people. No, they're not poor victims. We cater to them. I'm going to play, or at least I'm going to try to play, some commentary on this by Tucker Carlson. And this is a commentary he made on Fox News.
Almost 3,000 people were shot in the city of Chicago last year. Men, women, small children, sometimes alone, sometimes in groups. Many hundreds of them died. Not a single one of those people received anything like the attention the media have lavished on a relatively minor assault alleged by the television actor Jussie Smollett. On the other hand, none of Chicago's 3,000 shootings was even half as useful as Smollett's story. His story had everything. The national media long ago gave up the pretense of gathering news. Journalism is now explicitly a political job. The point of it is to enforce cultural orthodoxies and punish enemies. Jussie Smollett was the perfect vehicle for both of those things. Journalists pretended to be horrified as they recounted what he said happened to him, but secretly, they were thrilled.
There are many indications of a hate crime here. They are looking for two suspects who were apparently wearing Make America Great Again hats, though that has not yet been officially confirmed.
We don't know what happened to Jussie, but what we do know is that racism is alive and well in this country. There is real evidence of people who have done these crimes who cite that the president has inspired them.
The fact that it reportedly said this is MAGA country adds to sort of the atmosphere of menace that African Americans in particular, people of color in general, have felt since the advent of the Trump administration.
The media has really cast so much doubt on his story, which I find so personally offensive, that a gay black man is targeted and then suddenly he becomes the victim of people's disbelief.
He said his attackers hurled racial and homophobic slurs at him. And this is America in 2019.
That's CNN.
This is America in 2019. To the national media, Smollett's story was the perfect metaphor for the Trump era. It was also, pretty clearly, a total crock. Smollett's account began to fall apart within hours. After a series of leaks from the obviously skeptical Chicago Police Department, Smollett's handlers paired him with a network anchor they could rely on to launder the hoax. In the end, Smollett sat for 16 and a half minutes with Robin Roberts of Good Morning America. Roberts surely knew there was ample evidence that Smollett was lying, but she decided to ignore that. Instead, Roberts colluded with him. She nodded empathetically as Smollett wept on camera. She asked no significant follow-up questions. The two parted like old friends. Both Smollett and Roberts turned out to be talented actors. Check out their performance on YouTube before it's scrubbed. You'll never watch ABC News again. Virtually every word they utter is dishonest. Smollett began by explaining that the men who attacked him were not muggers. They didn't want money. They assaulted him purely because of his identity as a gay black Democrat. People like Jussie Smollett aren't allowed to live in Donald Trump's America. That was the message of the attackers. This is MAGA country, they screamed. They were referring, of course, to Chicago, a city where 88% of the population voted against Donald Trump. As a crime story, it didn't make a lot of sense. And when skeptics on the internet raised basic questions about his story, Smollett attacked them as racist.
If I had said it was a Muslim or a Mexican or someone black, I feel like the doubters would have supported me a lot much more. A lot more. And that says a lot about the place that we are in our country right now. The fact that we have these fear mongrels, these people that are trying to separate us, and it's just not okay.
What you just heard is a near perfect inversion of the truth, as Smollett himself might have put it. Who exactly is the fear mongrel here? Who is dividing us? And who exactly is the victim in all of this? Well, Smollett claims that he's the victim. He tells us that he represents the most despised and unfashionable groups in America. That's why bigots doubt his story. The rest of us nod as if this were true, because we're required to do that. That's how dishonest our society has become. Everyone must lie all the time. We know the rules. We have no choice. Meanwhile, our leaders immediately jump to the defense of this supposedly unpopular person before even hearing the evidence. Within hours, at least two presidential candidates had described what happened to Sumlet as a, quote, attempted lynching. They assumed on faith that he must be telling the truth. By definition, they smeared anyone who doubted him. They called him a hero. Is this the treatment that marginalized people receive? No, hardly. Smollett isn't powerless, far from it. His power lies in pretending that he has no power. In fact, Jussie Smollett and his promoters are the aggressors in this story. They launched a calculated campaign of slander against an entire group of people who have far less wealth and far less cultural influence than they have. If there's a bias crime here, they committed it. Will anyone be held accountable for this? Don't bet on it. In 1987, Al Sharpton introduced the media to a young woman called Tawana Brawley. Brawley had an awful story to tell. She said she'd been viciously raped by a group of racist white men and left in a garbage bag. She was covered in feces with racial slurs scrawled on her body. The Brawley case dominated headlines across the country for more than a year, and it bitterly divided New York City along ethnic lines. People hated each other because of what Tawana Brawley said happened to her. But it was all a lie. After conducting hundreds of interviews, a grand jury declared the entire story fraudulent. None of it actually happened. Brawley fled the state. A judge ordered Al Sharpton to pay for damages for accusing innocent men of rape. That should have been the end of Al Sharpton's career, yet just the opposite happened. Before he promoted Tawana Brawley's lie, Sharpton was best known as a small-time hustler, an FBI informant from Brooklyn, a man who'd once been James Brown's road manager. After he perpetuated the single most destructive racial hoax in memory, Al Sharpton got a promotion. He became a world-famous civil rights leader. He ran for president. He became a policy advisor to Barack Obama. According to visitor logs, Al Sharpton was invited to the Obama White House more than 80 times. He got his own show on MSNBC, which he still has. Sharpton has never apologized or even acknowledged the harm he did to this country by lying about Tawana Brawley. No one has forced him to. The lesson of Al Sharpton was clear to everyone watching. There are no penalties for hate hoaxes. There are only rewards. Not surprisingly, there have been many more since. The incident escalated dramatically after the 2016 election. The Muslim student in Louisiana who claimed she was assaulted by racists in Trump hats. The Muslim woman in San Diego who alleged the same. An anti-Asian attack in Minnesota. An anti-gay attack in California. A racial attack in Delaware. Racist graffiti at the Air Force Academy. Anti-Semitic threats phoned into Jewish community centers. All fake. Those and many, many more. The much-hyped epidemic of hate crimes you've heard so much about essentially is made up. The premise is America is not a hateful country. It's the most welcoming place on earth. That's why, even as our children learn from their teachers what a bigoted country this is, millions continue to stream in from Africa and Latin America for a better life here. It's why we've welcomed more refugees and immigrants than any nation in history. It's why we rescued a young Ilhan Omar from a refugee camp in Kenya. We are kind people. You see it in your own life. How many violent racists do you know personally? None, probably. That's because there aren't many in America. The left has to invent them. Stoking race hatred ensures continued power for the Democratic Party. Divided populations are easier to manipulate and rule. There would be no Democratic coalition without racial animosity. It's what holds their constituencies together. That's the point of identity politics. It's why they're forever reopening the wound. It's why Al Sharpton is still a revered figure among Democratic office holders. But to the cost to the country has been high. Ask the kids from Covington Catholic. For the crime of having unfashionable political beliefs and skin color, a group of entirely innocent high school students came close to having their lives destroyed. That didn't happen by accident. The national media did it. They concocted a hate crime out of nothing. The Twitter mob that demanded those boys be expelled from school and marked for life. Their parents were threatened. Their classmates were harassed. After 2 days, video surfaced proving that none of it was real. The mob moved on. But what if exculpatory video had not emerged? CNN panels would still be screaming for their blood. You sometimes hear people wonder why the media never seem to learn anything from moments like these, moments when they're exposed as corrupt and reckless. And so the answer to that question is very simple. It never occurs to them that they may be wrong or that they might have something to learn. The media see themselves as teachers, not as students. If you ever tried to put a sleepy four-year-old into a snowsuit before school, you know how journalists feel about the audience. It's frustrating when children don't understand or obey, but you've got to keep trying. That's how they feel. Listen as that oily media reporter kid from CNN explains that the Jussie Smollett hoax does not in any way reflect poorly on the people who promoted it.
Perhaps the questioning was not tough enough on Good Morning America, but ultimately this is not about the media or about politicians or activists or any of the people that might have been fooled. It's about Jussie.
Oh yeah, it's about Jussie. It definitely has nothing to do with any of us in the media who uncritically repeated his lies night after night for political effect. It's Jussie's problem now. That's Nancy Pelosi's new position too, by the way. Almost immediately after Smollett's story hit the news wires, the Speaker of the House denounced the racist and homophobic attack. Quote, may we all commit to ending this hate once and for all. Pelosi has since deleted that tweet. She has not apologized for her own role in perpetuating that hate. Pelosi should apologize, and not simply because it's good manners. Hate hoaxes make ethnic groups fear and distrust each other. That's a dangerous thing to do in a country that's becoming more diverse by the day. The only way to prevent future Tawana Brawleys and Jussie Smollett's is for the people who promoted these lies to acknowledge what they've done, ask for forgiveness for doing it, and pledge to stop judging others on the basis of racial stereotypes. We need to resolve the Jussie Smollett story. We can't just move on to the next thing and act like it never happened, which is their plan. Smollett himself made that point, actually, at the end of his interview on Good Morning America. Watch.
I still want to believe, with everything that has happened, that there's something called justice.
We've got that in common. Something called justice. We all want to believe in that.
And that was Tucker Carlson commenting on the Jussie Smollett story. A very good commentary. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Here's a case, and once again demonstrating the capture of much of the Canadian judiciary by cultural Marxists who buy into the victimology tale, women good, men bad. And several judges who hadn't quite got their marching orders have run afoul of this, including a nominee for the Supreme Court of Canada. Anyway, I'll skip him to go to the most recent case. And the woman in question here, or at least the judge in question who apparently didn't get it, is herself a woman. Trial judge overruled in sex assault acquittal. An acquittal in a sexual assault case was tossed aside on Wednesday and a new trial ordered because the trial judge had relied on myths on how victims should behave. A myth. Now, a myth is an explanatory story that is that at least on the surface that is not correct. It's an imaginative story, let's put it this way. Okay, well, let's get down to the details. In ordering a new trial, the Ontario Court of Appeals found the reliance on discredited stereotypes by Superior Court Justice Elisa Mitchell amounted to a legal error. So she relied on discredited stereotypes. Stay tuned. Normally, appeals courts will not weigh in on a trial judge's credibility findings unless they're based on legal error. In this case, the appeal court found reason to second-guess the judge's findings. Now, this is really quite extreme. Reliance upon stereotypical views about how victims of sexual assault would behave is an error of law, the court said. So the judge apparently was relying on stereotypes. Now, yeah, you know, the way that's worded would make you think a stereotype is false. A stereotype is a generalization based on reality. A stereotype is not wrong. It's a generalization based on observable reality. The only thing is a stereotype. It is a correct generalization that, of course, will not be correct in every case. Boys are messy, and like to roll around on the ground and get their clothes dirty. As a generalization, we're talking young boys, let's hope, as a generalization about young males, that is likely true. That would be called a stereotype. As a predictor of young boys' behavior, it's a useful guide. Does every young boy like to, is every young boy messy and okay with rolling around in the dirt or the grass, you know, fooling around or whatever? Well, no. There are some sensitive souls or some boys who from early age are not messy. The usefulness of generalizations or stereotypes is it helps to predict and organize reality. But every wise person knows that the generalization doesn't work in every case. Little girls are grossed out and are afraid of wiggly things like worms. That's a generalization or a stereotype. It's true more often than not. But there are some girls, tomboys or whatever, young girls we're talking about, who don't mind wiggly things like worms, so would even be maybe better at baiting a hook than their brother. Generalizations are only that. They're true more often than not. And it's a helpful way to predict reality. Anyway, it's important to have our definition down before we actually get into the facts of the case. The case turned on the credibility of the complainant and that of her brother-in-law, who can only be identified as ABA. I know there's probably reason in these sexual cases that identities be kept private, but the entire, our entire system just is choking with right to privacy. Now, of course, if you and I are charged with a crime, don't kid ourselves. As racial activists, we won't be having any privacy. But back to the facts. Court records show the woman accused ABA, who was separated at the time from his wife, of rape. The ABA is her brother-in-law. Of rape, enforcing oral sex on her at her apartment multiple times over the course of a day. That also included going out together for food, drinking beer, and consuming cocaine. She alleged she again sexually assaulted her several times 5 days later at her sister's place. I take it her brother-in-law is her sister's husband. Okay. ABA insisted all the sexual activity was consensual. So, okay. let's get the facts of the case as alleged. So she accuses her brother-in-law, who was separated from his wife at the time, so I guess sexually free, at least in his from his point of view, of rape, enforcing oral sex on her at her apartment multiple times over the course of a day. That also included going out together for food, drinking beer, and consuming cocaine. And the similar assault occurred 5 days later at her sister's place. At trial in London, Ontario, the woman testified that she was terrified of her brother-in-law. She said she fought back on some occasions, but submitted to the alleged assaults because she was afraid of him. And Judge Mitchell, adopting what she called a common sense approach. Oh, no, did she really? The judge? A common sense approach? Well, you can't have that. Common sense might just contradict the cultural Marxist ideology. And you remember what that is? Men bad, women good. So Mitchell, adopting what she called, that's Judge Mitchell, adopting what she called a common sense approach, found that the woman had failed to flee or call for help, and had continued to associate with the man after the assault, the alleged assaults. That conduct, the judge found, undermined her credibility. You think? On the day in the first day in question, where he raped her and forced her on numerous occasions that day to have to give him oral sex, they also went out together to eat, went drinking, and consumed cocaine. Now, I think a reasonable person might say, well, look, if it was not consensual on some level, then why didn't you leave? Why would you go to eat with him? Why not go? Like, keep going. The judge felt this had undermined her credibility. She's either scared to fight back and tell him to stop or not, Mitchell said in her judgment. The fact she behaved inconsistently in this regard weakens her credibility. Would you not agree? I mean, I would. She's claiming this sex was not consensual, right? And she's subjecting him to this brother-in-law to a very, very, very serious charge. You know, repeated rape, really. In April of last year, Judge Mitchell acquitted ABA. On appeal, the prosecution argued that the judge's reliance on myths or generalized assumptions about how sexual assault victims are expected to behave amounted to legal error. The Crown is insane. These are not assumptions about how a victim ought to behave. As the judge said, it's common sense. You know, because all of this turns on whether the sex, or the repeated sex in this case, was consensual, as the accused argues, or forced, as the complainant, the accuser, argues. Well, in a he said, she said case, and we'll assume, at least from this news story, that there's no other corroborating evidence, like there isn't a video of the events or eyewitnesses or whatever, but assuming that, then it comes down to he said, she said, and it comes down to credibility. And the stories of both parties, the accused and the accuser, deserve to be tested for credibility. And I think the judge, as she says, using a common sense approach, quite rightly wondered, well, if it's not consensual, why did you not get away when you had a chance to get away? We're not talking about some extraordinary physical battle or anything like that. Why did you not, why did you go out to eat with him rather than the minute you're free from whatever degree of confinement you might be in, to flee? ABA countered that Mitchell had deemed him a credible witness, that he's the accused, and had accepted his view that the sex was consensual. As such, he argued, that was enough for an acquittal, regardless of the judge's view of the complainant's credibility. And he's quite right. I mean, it hinged on the complainant's credibility. And in fact, he may also have a further good point, which the appeals court did not accept, but that creates reasonable doubt. Inherent in this position is a comparison of the complainant's behavior to what Judge Mitchell viewed was appropriate. I don't think she said appropriate behavior. That she should have expected of an adult threatened with a sexual assault or a victim of sexual assault, the appeal court wrote. The issue here was not what steps the complainant should have taken to protect herself, but rather whether she consented to sexual activity. In my opinion, that's saying the same thing in two different ways. If the sex was not consensual, that she did not take any steps when she had the chance. I particularly balk at this business of going out to dinner with him. The fact that she did not take steps at that point to get away or to cease the contact strongly suggests consent. Anyway, this will now go back for a retrial. What I find particularly appalling about this is that the appeals court has lost all sense of common sense, and particularly in areas of sex. Sex is, I was going to say a game, and that's probably not quite the right term. Sex is, in some ways, a dance. In many cultures, including for a good period of time our own, the woman must appear to be reluctant or needs to be persuaded. She does not want to appear to be too easy. Or in some points of view, sex is a valued award that must be earned, and so the woman will feign some reluctance. Now, where is the difference between a woman playing the game, feigning reluctance, and real reluctance? Well, it's a hazy line. And before the severe penalties are imposed upon a man for rape, that is, sex without consent, the courts will want to be sure. And so the credibility of the witness is very much an issue. And testing credibility is a matter of testing the events in and around the case. Anyway, I find this one more very sad example of our cases, of our courts absolutely gone off the rail. Well, this is Paul Fromm. I'm going to take my musical break right now. I'm going to start off with Heather Miles. And wow, this is a great old country and western song. This is a Ray Price tune. Crazy Arms.
Someone else's love.
Clark and, Heather Miles and the old Ray Price tune, Crazy Arms. Here's a song that I hope you'll like with Patti Loveless, and this was in a tribute to the late Porter Wagoner. Actually, I think he was very ill at the time. He was in the audience, and she's actually addressing him.
It's so good to be here, especially tonight for Porter Wagoner. I love you, darling, and I recall you doing this song, and then I recall you and Dolly doing it together as well, and they're for you. If teardrops were pink and heartaches were gold, an anchor of diamond I'd offer to you, this whole world would be yours to have and to hold. Teardrops were pennies and heartaches were gold. Teardrops were pennies and heartaches were gold. I'd have all the treasures my pockets would hold. I'd be I'm a honky-tonk cowboy.
Becky Hobbs, Honky Tonk Saturday Night. And here's a duet with Becky and Mo Bandy. Let's get over them together. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com.
I don't know if we can make it, but maybe let's give it a good try.
We're both coming off of losing, and it ain't easy telling love goodbye.
You don't look a thing like her, and I don't guess I measure up to him. Maybe together we can get each other over them. Let's get over them together and burn two old memories. Let's get over them together. Somewhere that's out of sight.
Before this night is over, who knows? Two losers might win and smile again.
Maybe together we can get each other over them. Let's get over them together. To old memories. Let's get over them together. I'll help you and you help me. Let's get over them together.
This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here made to wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle shamrock rose and wine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the phrase to Nootka's sound. May peace forever be our lot, and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless.